This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. And your number is 877-217-5757. Email us, talk@talklouisiana.org. Alondra Villarreal is producing. And we start our show on a busy news day. We do want to note that the Saints have lost their coach of the last 16 years and 15 seasons, Sean Payton, who won 152 games and brought winning as a tradition to New Orleans for a franchise that had gone through a bad spell for much of the years preceding his hiring in 2006. And Payton's era culminated with a championship, the only Super Bowl title for New Orleans, on February 6, 2010, in the Miami venue, if the Saints beat the Indianapolis Colts to win the Super Bowl number 44. But Sean Payton had a great career, and we wish him well at age 58. Who knows, he might end up coaching or being in a broadcast booth, but he's been successful in his life, and he gave his all to the great city of New Orleans and to our state, and we appreciate him for doing that. Jill Kraft is with us, a lawyer of note, as she represents many people who have been offended and go to courts to express their grievances, and she is noted for her success in that realm. And I was actually surprised, and this is a point that I'm making, she's not making. I was surprised when Sharon Lewis, the associate athletic director at LSU, filed her lawsuit against LSU a few months ago, that she had not hired Jill Kraft, who is probably the go-to person when it comes to these kinds of suits. And Sharon Lewis is no longer working at LSU. She was fired this month after filing the lawsuit, but it took some months, and 40 other people have also been fired since Brian Kelly became the head coach at LSU, fired or reassigned. But Lewis, who handled football recruiting and alumni relations under several coaches, she was hired by Nick Saban, did her job very well, according to reports. And those of us who know her knows that she was a person of great success. Nick Saban tried to hire her at Alabama at one point, but she ran into a tough spot with Les Miles, and that's all detailed in the lawsuit. And Miles, according to her, wanted only blonde women working in his office with large breasts. And Sharon Lewis did not want that to happen because she knew the implications of it and didn't follow Les Miles' order. And according to her, this is one of many allegations that she made, Les Miles threatened to beat her up. Now, Les Miles has responded. Attorneys for him have filed a motion for sanctions against Lewis's attorney, arguing they failed to conduct a reasonable pre-filing investigation of the law and facts before asserting unsupported and unfounded Title IX and civil RICO claims against the former coach. And this presumably will be worked out in federal court. The case has been moved to New Orleans because no judge in Baton Rouge wanted to touch this. They all recused themselves, and that brings us to Jill Kraft. And Jill, certainly the fact that she's been fired adds the prospect of, quote, wrongful termination as another allegation. What's your take on where things stand at this point?
Well, it was kind of surprising to me when I looked at the lawsuit. I got a copy of it yesterday, that they filed suit against the state of Louisiana under the civil rights statute in federal court. You just can't do that. It's long been understood that the state is not a person, so they can't be held responsible for civil rights. The question of Ms. Lewis's termination is going to be one I would assume ultimately answered by the court, but just because somebody files a lawsuit doesn't mean that they're protected, you know, indefinitely. Companies are allowed to make business decisions. They're allowed to move forward. They're allowed to fire people that have filed lawsuits. The distinction being, you cannot fire somebody because they filed a lawsuit or because they reported unlawful conduct or because they reported what they reasonably believe to be discrimination. That's going to be the critical question for the courts. Can she prove causation between her termination and whatever protected activity she claims?
877-217-5757 if you'd like to get in with Jill Kraft in our segment with her. Now, Tiger Rag, a publication I'm familiar with as the proprietor, broke this story. Adam Hunsaker, the editor, is the one who reported it first, and then others followed suit, including Andrea Gallo, who's been covering this story very well for The Advocate. But Sharon Lewis is a person of merit. She is president of the National L Club, which means that all the lettermen and letterwomen at LSU and all sports have elected her to be their president, and that is a post they cannot take away from her. So there is this very interesting prospect of the president of the National L Club being fired by LSU for cause. Now, what would the cause be other than the fact that she filed this lawsuit? Can LSU explain? What do you think, Jill?
Well, generally speaking, that's precisely what LSU is going to do. The way that the law works currently on a retaliation or even a discrimination claim is the plaintiff says, I've been the victim of retaliation. I was terminated, for example, because I engaged in protected activity. The burden then shifts to the employer to articulate or identify a legitimate non-retaliatory reason. And then on paper, this is before you ever get to the inside of a courtroom, the burden then would shift back to Ms. Lewis to prove exactly what I said earlier. That is that the retaliation was because of her protected activities. There are a couple of cases over time that talk about if you have closeness in proximity and time between the protected activity, for example, you have an employee who says, I think I'm being discriminated against, and a month later they're fired. The court said under those circumstances where there's closeness, generally 3 months or less, the court can infer that retaliation was a likely motive. But in Ms. Lewis's circumstance, I'm not sure that she's going to have the benefit of closeness and proximity and timing. It may be that she's got additional evidence, comments made by the decision makers, actions that were taken. Some of the things the courts can look at in terms of proof is if she can disprove the reason LSU gave or prove that the reason LSU gave for terminating her was false or otherwise a pretext for retaliation. So, I mean, it's complicated from the standpoint that a lot of the heavy lifting in retaliation and discrimination claims take place on paper. Right. It's not uncommon for most of the discrimination retaliation claims to be dismissed by motion practice. I think the national average is something abysmal, like 80% of them are dismissed before they ever get to trial. So I suspect what you're going to see a lot of in this case is a lot of paper motions, motions to dismiss, motions to take out claims. It's going to be hard fought, not on the battlefields of the courtroom, but frankly, in the process of killing trees.
All right. And when I said fired with cause, obviously when people are fired, there's always a cause. It may have just been financial, but in this case, you'd have to say, does this meet the smell test? And the stated reason for LSU is that she was fired, quote, without cause. And in Louisiana, as Jill knows fully well, you don't have to tell an employee why you're firing them. You can just fire them, right?
That's right. We're an employment at will state, which means an employer does not have to have any reason for firing somebody. I will caution, however, when you have a termination without cause and you've got somebody who is, actively in litigation against you, claiming already that tangible actions have been taken against her because she protested unlawful activity, you would hope that folks would take the extra step and make sure whatever they're doing is documented and they can demonstrate that reason is not a pretext for an unlawful reason. But we're going to kind of have to see how those chips play out and how this case ends up playing out, most of which, as I've indicated, is going to be on paper and not in a courtroom.
Now, her attorneys are Larry English, Bridget Brown, and Tammy Brown. And the lawsuit, and I'm no authority, you are, but I think it's 124 pages, has a whole bunch of stuff in there. Human nature is such that our attention span is not that great. 124 pages might seem a bit excessive. Is it basically throwing everything out there, hoping some of it will stick? What's your take on the presentation, which of course is a big part of legal filings? You've got to make a good case. Was it a good presentation?
It was a long presentation. Typically, I try to keep my complaints to exactly what the code says, which is a short, plain statement of the claims upon which relief can be granted. There are folks who litigate in terms of, let me throw out every possible scenario and see what sticks on the wall. The concern I always have in federal court and state court is that we as lawyers are bound by our ethics rules and by rules of court, which require that we have a good faith, rational belief for the claims we're asserting on behalf of someone.
Carol, I know we're short on time. Carol and Jefferson, you're on. Let's go to Carol. Please be brief. Hi.
Yes. We need to define what fired is. Usually when you fire, it's because of something you've done.
Okay. That's the point that was made, is that firings just don't happen usually because somebody walks in and says, you know, I don't think you should be here. There has to be a reason, but legally there is with cause and without cause, and LSU says this was without cause, and that could be significant, Jill.
Well, it could be, but again, without cause can be as simple as we're having budget issues within the department. We've decided to downsize. We've decided to reorganize. That's not a cause by Ms. Lewis.
All right, we do have to roll, but Jill Kraft will be calling again soon. Thank you so much. We're back after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. We're glad you are with us, and we turn the page and go to politics. And, of course, some people are shaking their heads to talk about politics. LSU is always rife with politics. But Alondra Villarreal is producing, and we are now visiting with our dear friend Ray Strother from Bozeman, Montana, and this man who has worked with all the luminaries of Democratic note for a generation in the latter part of the 20th century and early in the 21st century. 3 years ago, he was given a terminal diagnosis. I think doctors, when they give you that, they're saying, you know, you got about 6 months. You better get your affairs in order, say your goodbyes. And here it is 3 years later, and Ray Strother, who last year was supposedly knocking on heaven's door, is still with us and still lucid and still Ray. And good morning, my friend. It's great to hear your voice.
Good morning. It's good to be here. I mean that more than one way.
Well, you are a warrior, and thank God you're fighting the good fight.
And, well, what else are you going to do?
It is an amazing story, and Ray Strother is still here to talk politics like he can do. As he does, like few others. 877-217-5757. And for those who've listened to this program through the years, they know that Ray handled Bill Clinton's odyssey as governor of Arkansas from his second victory, which would have been in 1982, through his last victory in 1990. And then he and the governor, they parted, and didn't part on the best of terms, but I know Ray can probably address the strengths and weaknesses of this man better than anybody else. And when Bill Clinton had to choose another political consultant, he went with another guy who used to work with Ray, James Carville, and we know what happened. But it was on this date in 1992 that Bill Clinton went on 60 Minutes and saved his presidential campaign. He was accused of having an affair with Jennifer Flowers, and in those days, that was big news. It could sack a candidate, as it did Gary Hart, Ray Strother's candidate back in the year of 1984 and briefly in 1987 leading up to the 88 campaign. Gary Hart was a hot candidate. If he'd won the nomination in 84, he certainly would have done better than Walter Mondale, but that did not happen. But Bill Clinton survived a scandal, and here's how it sounded on this date, January 26, 1992, Steve Croft of 60 Minutes.
It's been quite a week for Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton. On Monday, his picture was on the cover of Time magazine, anointed by the press as the frontrunner for the Democratic presidential nomination. 6 days later, he's trying to salvage his campaign. His problem? Long-rumored allegations of marital infidelity finally surfaced in a supermarket tabloid. And last week, they were picked up and reprinted, unsubstantiated, by the mainstream press. Since then, for better or for worse, Governor Clinton's private life has become the overriding issue in the Democratic presidential campaign. Earlier today, Governor Clinton and his wife Hillary sat down with me to try to put the issue to rest. Keep in mind, as we said earlier, all of the allegations are unsubstantiated. All have been denied by everyone involved, except for the case of Jennifer Flowers, a former television reporter and cabaret singer. Jennifer Flowers, in a tabloid interview for which she was paid, says she carried on a long-term affair with Governor Clinton from the late 1970s through the end of 1989.
Who is Jennifer Flowers? You know her. Oh, yes.
How do you know? How would you describe your relationship?
Very limited, but until this, you know, friendly, but limited. I met her in the late 70s when I was attorney general. And she was one of a number of young people who were working for the television stations around Little Rock. And, the people in politics and the people in the media knew each other then, just as they do now. She left our state, and for years I didn't really hear from her, know what she was doing. Then she came back, sometime a few years ago, and went to work again in the state. So that's who she is.
Was she a friend, an acquaintance? Does your wife know her?
Oh, yes. Oh,
sure.
She was an acquaintance, I would say, a friendly acquaintance. When this rumor story got started in the middle of 1980, and she was contacted and told about it, she was so upset, and she called back and she said, how can I be listed on this? I haven't seen you for more than 10 minutes in 10 years. She would call from time to time when she was upset or thought she was really in being hurt by the rumors. And I would call her back. Either she would call the office, or I'd call her back there at the office, or I'd call her back at the house. And Hillary knew when I was calling her back. I think once I called her when we were together. And so there's nothing out of the ordinary there.
She's a legend, and is described in some detail in a supermarket tabloid, which she calls a 12-year affair with you.
That allegation is false.
When this woman first got caught up in these charges, I felt, as I felt about all of these women, that, you know, they've just been minding their own business and they got hit by a meteor. I mean, it was no fault of their own. We reached out to them. I met with two of them to reassure them. They were friends of ours. I felt terrible about what was happening to them. You know, Bill talked to this woman every time she called, distraught, saying her life was going to be ruined. And, you know, he'd get off the phone and tell me that she said sort of wacky things, which we thought were attributable to the fact that she was terrified.
It was only when money came out, when the tabloid went down there offering people money.
That was Bill Clinton, 1992. Now, later in the deposition, he did admit he had an affair with Jennifer Flowers. But a day after this appearance on 60 Minutes, Governor Clinton came to Baton Rouge and got the endorsement of Governor Edwin Washington Edwards. Kind of interesting. And the story goes that Ray Strother, when Clinton was asked, what do I say when they ask me? She claiming we had a torrid 12-year affair. He says, you tell them there's no such thing. And so Bill Clinton survived a scandal, and he perhaps set a roadmap for others who were embroiled in sexual misconduct allegations. What do you think about this as a historic moment in political consulting?
Oh, I think it probably is notable, but something's interesting about this that people don't believe when I tell them, and that I was around Bill Clinton for a long time. And in fact, I would stay at the mansion. There's a little house back behind the mansion, that a guest house, and I would stay there. So I was with him an extraordinary amount of time. He was a guy who tended to work very, very late, like 2 o'clock in the morning. And I'm not good at that time. But anyway, I spent a lot of time with him. But the point I'm making is I never, ever, ever saw him do anything that would have made my life more difficult as a political consultant. I never saw him with another woman. And as I said, I was with him a lot. I did the response to State of the Union. He was my spokesperson. And so he came and hung out in Washington for, I don't know, 4 or 5 days. And I was with him, you know, constantly. I never saw anything untoward. So, and this, I can say the same thing about Gary Hart. So I don't know if it's me or them, but both of them changed the way we look at politics. And unfortunately, I was there for both of them, although I particularly like Gary Hart. I think he's the most capable man I've ever known in politics. But I had in and outs with Bill Clinton for a long, long time. But I never saw anything that would have indicted him in any way.
Well, today in the 24-hour news cycle, any gaffe is met with attention by media people, and some people call themselves media types on the World Wide Web and elsewhere. And And Donald Trump was able to withstand allegations that he paid $130,000 to the Pride of Baton Rouge, Stormy Daniels, to keep quiet about an affair he had with a porn star, and he got away with it. He talked about how he liked to grab people, women, by the pee. That was all his words on tape in the All Access Hollywood tape, and he survived. And here Joe Biden today is apologizing for insulting a Fox reporter, Steve Doocy. Biden called him a stupid SOB, and he used the full words, and then he apologized and said, look, man, it's not personal. And Doocy, to his credit, laughed it off, saying nobody's fact-checked him to say if it's true or not. So we will talk with Ray Strother about the new era of national and Louisiana politics in which every word is parsed, and every candidate is on the hot seat if they are viable. And we've got a U.S. Senate race coming in Louisiana with some interesting candidates. We'll also hear from Ron Fauché when we return after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. A few more minutes with Ray Strother, the legendary political consultant. Went to Washington in the year of 1980, and he was one of a handful of political consultants in the nation's capital. Now there are thousands of operatives teeming in the Beltway, but Ray Strother was on the ground floor. He wrote a great autobiography about his life and times, Falling Up, and it is a must-read for those who are political junkies. 877-217-5757 is your number, and talk at talklouisiana.org. And Tom on Bluebonnet notes, in listening to that tape with Bill and Hillary Clinton on 60 Minutes 30 years ago, Hillary had perfected a fake Southern accent pretty well, Ray Strother. Did you notice she sounded a little different then than she does now? Okay.
She was very pliable. She was a good politician. She knew what she was doing. You know, I really didn't notice the accent, I guess because I don't have one. It's hard for me to hear other people with an accent. Uh-huh. But I've heard other people say that she did become a little bit more Southern. You know, one thing she did was when she married Clinton when he was attorney general and through his first term as governor, she didn't use his name. She used the name Rodham. And people of Arkansas really held that against her. So when he ran for the second term, where I came in, she had already changed her name legally, I guess, to Clinton. So she knew how to take advantage of opportunities.
And another listener notes that in the year of 1984, when Ray Strother was guiding Gary Hart to a near victory, and that, was, by the way, was a very close contest with him and Walter Mondale for the Democratic nomination in 1984, that none other than Brian Kelly, coach of LSU, was a driver for Gary Hart. Did you know him at all?
No, I didn't. You know, a presidential campaign is so huge. There are probably hundreds of people, most volunteers. And I don't recall him, although I may have been with him more than once. I don't recall him, but there were just masses of young people, young idealists, and he must have been one or he wouldn't have been there because they certainly didn't go there for the money.
James in Carville, that's not James Carville, but James in Carville, writes, should Democratic candidates tout the massive benefits to Louisiana contained in the recently passed infrastructure bill leading up to the midterms? Your thoughts, Ray?
Well, you know, I find it interesting, this Republican governor of Montana who's anti-anything Democratic is now taking credit for the money that's coming to Montana. And I think we'll see that everywhere with this new infrastructure. Every time there's a new highway, we're going to find an opponent to it taking credit for it. So that's not a surprise to me.
We're going to hear from Ron Fauché and get his take in just a moment. But, Ray, what are your thoughts about the midterms? Are Democrats in trouble, or can things change in a few months?
Well, historically, Democrats are in trouble. And, you know, poor Biden, you know, he's a guy I've known and worked for since 84, I guess, 83, 84. He sat down at a poker table, and the hand was already dealt to him. COVID, the economy, inflation coming because of the pent-up spending. I mean, there were a lot of things that were going to make it very difficult for him. And he was elected because he was at the right place at the right time. But so was Trump. So was Clinton. You know, timing is everything. So people running right now in midterms are running in, particularly Republicans, running at an opportune time where the Democrats are showing some weakness. So, you know, I hate to be a naysayer, but I think it's we're going to see some major changes in Washington come the midterms.
And before we go to Ron Fauché, David in Atlanta has been waiting to talk with Ray Strother. David, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. Let me give you an example of how Republicans seem to win the lies and propaganda war. And it didn't really start with Trump, trust me. After Katrina, I came to Atlanta. Herman Cain was on a 50,000-watt station in Atlanta. He said the only thing Clinton did as president was raise taxes. And I called to tell him in 1995, President Clinton was on the capital gains tax cut, the holy grail of the Republican Party, that reduced the effective rate of the 400 individual wealthiest Americans from 30% to 22%. And I emailed him the article from the New York Times. I was essentially called a liar and banned from the program.
All right. Bill Clinton, as a person, a very complex man, as politicians often are. But on the record, I think Carville is correct when he says, what did you not like about it, the peace or the prosperity? So he had a good record as president, Ray.
He did. He was I think he was a good president. I'm glad I voted for him, and I'm glad he was there. Our differences were very minor, to be quite honest with you, and didn't really involve him at all.
Involved Dick Morris, didn't it?
it involved Dick Morris and a woman named Betsy Wright and, you know, a few people like that. But Clinton and I always actually got along pretty well and probably still do if I ran into him today.
Now,
you have Ron Fauché kind of. That's the guy you ought to listen to.
Well, Ron, of course, is he's a guy who's well regarded here and elsewhere. He started that publication many years ago, Campaigns and Elections, which was the must read. It was the Bible of national politics. But before we part company with you today, and I hope we visit again very soon, Ray. A listener asked a good question, and I think her memory is correct. This is Holly in the Garden District asking about when Karch, your candidate, got out in 1987 because of a sex scandal involving Donna Rice. Clinton certainly was interested in running perhaps at that point, and did he not call you and ask for your advice? What happened?
Well, he called me and asked me to come to Little Rock, and I went immediately to Little Rock once Gary had decided that he couldn't run anymore, and met with a group of people at the mansion to get him ready to run for president. And we began writing speeches and putting together an announcement and everything just shortly after that, because Clinton was already my client, so it wasn't like I was switching sides or anything like that. And I did it with the approval of Gary Hart. For some reason, after we got all ready to run, he didn't run. And, I've always suspected that Hillary had told him no. She did hold the keys to the safe there because she had to defend him on 60 Minutes, when it came time. And she wouldn't have done that at this particular time in 87, I suspect. But it was a troubling time for me because I was caught between campaigns and candidates, and I'd already resigned most of my work due to the Gary Hart campaign. And some real heroes called me back and said, let's go back to work, like Lloyd Benson in Texas and Dennis DeConcini in Arizona and Paul Simon. So anyway, I had a host of people who came home, but that was a very upsetting time. I was actually at an Orioles baseball game when I talked to Clinton.
Really? And he almost got in, and you talk about timing. In 1988, if he had received the nomination, he would have been 42 years old, and he probably would have lost to George Bush in 88, but he beat him in 92. So timing is everything, my friend. Timing is everything.
Timing is everything.
And thank God you're with us, and we'll be calling again soon. Keep going, Ray Strother. You inspire me.
I'll do my best, and you call me anytime you wish.
Will do.
And I'm hanging on to listen to Ron Fauché.
Okay, and as mentioned, Ron Fauché, former state lawmaker, he was the founder of Campaigns and Elections, the go-to publication for politicians and political junkies in Washington and beyond. And he's still in the game all these years later. Pride of New Orleans, and he follows Louisiana earnestly as well as the rest of the country. And we do have a U.S. Senate race here, and for those of us who follow it, I think John Kennedy is still in relatively good shape. The only way he could be in trouble is if he's challenged within his party, which is a possibility, but it has not happened yet. But there's some interesting candidates running as Democrats. Luke Mixon is a guy who is a very good candidate. He just is in the wrong state unless he can somehow, some way, force Kennedy into a runoff. And then there's Gary Chambers, who is a lightning rod of lightning rods, who probably knows that at this point he's unlikely to win, but he is likely to make news. And, Ron, I never thought I'd see the day when a candidate would tout a campaign commercial smoking marijuana. But there was Gary Chambers last week, and the nation was enthralled with that story.
Well, politics change, as Raymond Strother was explaining. And by the way, it was great hearing his learned voice talk about his experiences. But you know, that's right. Not too long ago, candidates were making it very clear they had never smoked marijuana, were raising their hands. And Bill Clinton took a lot of heat, if you remember, when he said, well, he had never inhaled. Gary Chambers doing that is very unusual, even for modern times. And it's really an attempt by him, I think, to get attention. He represents pretty much the hard left, the hard progressive left. He ran for Congress and did quite well about a year ago in a special election. And so now he's going to do it statewide. His candidacy actually will probably hurt Luke Mixon's candidacy, because the only way you have a shot at beating somebody like Kennedy is either have one candidate go at him head on or to put him into a runoff. And somebody like Chambers, I think, kind of makes it a little more difficult for Mixon to make the point that the Democratic Party is that at least his Democratic Party is more of a centrist party, with somebody like Chambers running far to the left. But in any case, Jim, as you said, Kennedy's the clear favorite. He's going to have all the Republican establishment.
And $11 million. And we've got to take a break, but we will return. It's been another segment with Ron Fauché, 877-217-5757, back after this brief pause. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us. Alondra Villarreal is producing, and we're pleased to have as our guest for the final segment, Ron Fauché, the noted pollster, political consultant, pundit, and columnist, and he follows Louisiana and national politics as well or better than anybody we know. And Ron Fauché is, as we went to the break, was assessing the U.S. Senate race, which right now is solid Kennedy, and a Republican could give him some fits if somebody were to get in the race. But Kennedy, despite doing everything to the contrary the last few years, Ron, has actually moved a little to the middle, which would be expected if he has no candidates on the right side. He basically has said the insurrection was a terrible thing and that Biden won the election. So those things would not sit well with Donald Trump if Trump had another option in the race. But the former president has endorsed Mr. Kennedy for re-election. And with $11 million, John Kennedy can withstand a lot of competitors on the left side of the spectrum. But what would happen if he had somebody from the right who got in the race? What would happen at that point?
Well, anybody from the right would risk, you know, pulling some votes off of him and open the possibility of putting him to a runoff. But it would take a particularly strong candidate to do that. The Republicans, I think, will unite around John Kennedy. Kennedy was really a staunch Trump supporter in terms of Senate votes and Senate activity when
Trump was president. So ultimately, Trump will be with Kennedy, and the political establishment of the Republican Party will be with Kennedy. And as you point out, he's going to be able to raise an enormous amount of money from Republican sources. So even if somebody from the right ran, unless it was a candidate who was particularly good and effective and had a lot of money, I doubt that they would draw much vote against him.
877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org for our man Ron Fauché and John Kennedy. He sends me emails on a regular basis, and I'm pleased to get them. I chuckle a bit, but it is so over the top. It is unbelievable, and especially for those of us who knew John Kennedy when he was not only a Democrat, but by Louisiana standards, a leftist Democrat. Here he sent one out, Ron. It says, leftist media snobs will support anyone. Jim, the East Coast media elites are just fawning all over my woke opponent. I guess he's referring to Chambers, because he gets high to get by. That's right. You heard me correctly. I've seen just about everything there is to see in my day other than the pearly gates, but this takes the cake. If you don't believe me, see for yourself. And then he presents the video of Gary Chambers. So John Kennedy at this point is laughing all the way to reelection. He's a pretty good bean counter. I think he knows that at this point the field is in his favor.
Well, you know, so much of politics now is about raising money. Some of the U.S. Senate campaigns in the 2020 election, I mean, just spent hundreds of millions of dollars, which is way more than we've ever seen before. So it's become a pretty big money operation. And to raise money, both sides send out these ridiculous emails that go over the top. And they use it to sort of paint their opponents as sort of nuts and quacks and evil people. and when you get somebody like Chambers in the race, it makes it easy for them to do that. You know? And of course, Kennedy will use Chambers' candidacy to raise a lot of money. And Luke Mixon, as you say, he's not well known among the voters in the state, but he's another Democrat running, but he has some real potential, I think, in politics as a candidate. Mm-hmm. And Chambers's entry into the race really complicates his situation.
And Mixon, if he runs a good race, let's say he finishes second with 30% of the vote, that would be a good race. He's positioned perhaps to come back and run for governor next year. And, you know, I talked with Governor Edwards, and I don't think he would mind me repeating this. He's obviously a pretty good politician himself. He said, look, if you've got three or four Republicans running for governor, he says, don't count out a Democrat getting in a runoff next year if it's a good candidate. And Mixon could parlay this into a run next year. But other than him, the Democrats' depth of bench isn't very strong when it comes to getting a candidate in the race for governor in 2023. Is it?
No, it really isn't. There's very few Democrats who are being mentioned as possible Democratic candidates for governor, and none of them really have much state name recognition. You know, the strongest Democrats in the state were Mary Landrieu and Mitch Landrieu, and assuming neither one of them runs, if a Democrat would run, it would be somebody who is largely unknown. So at this point, I think there's a lot of pent-up desire on the part of Republican and conservative voters to elect a Republican governor after 4 years of a Democratic governor. So at this point, I'd handicap the chances of a Democrat getting elected governor are fairly slim. But you never know. If you get an appealing Democratic candidate in a runoff with a Republican candidate who isn't appealing and who may have some personal problems, then it can change the dynamics, as we saw 8 years ago.
Yes, indeed. But that was a special race, and John Bel Edwards, who's a very good candidate, has benefited from the field twice. He had a wounded David Vitter in 2015, and he had a newcomer in Eddie Rasponi in 2019. But That's what Ray Strother was talking about. Timing is everything in politics. Now, the candidates who are professing that they plan to run right now on the Republican side all have something to give up. They're all statewide office holders. There's Billy Nungesser, Jeff Landry, and now John Schroeder. And as you know, Ron, the race for governor in Louisiana is tailor-made for a Washington person to get in because they don't have to give up anything because it's an off year for them. And the hot rumor of the moment is that Bill Cassidy might get in. If he were to run, you make a great point. I don't think a Democrat's going to win next year, but the Democratic voters could ultimately decide who does win among the Republicans. Your thoughts?
I think Cassidy potentially could be a very, very strong candidate for governor. Number one, he has statewide name recognition, even though he has a strong conservative record as a U.S. senator. He also, parted ways with Donald Trump on a number of highly celebrated matters, and that helped him with the Democrats and the independent voters in the state. So if Cassidy gets into a runoff against a pro-Trump Republican, it's possible that he could win the governorship with the votes of not only his own base within the Republican Party, but with Democratic and independent votes. If he gets into a runoff against a Democrat, then many of those Republicans who are unhappy with Cassidy's position on Trump would come home. Who are they going to vote for? A candidate of the party of Biden and Harris and Pelosi? Or are they going to vote for a candidate with a 93% conservative voting record? So I think even though a lot of people believe that Bill Cassidy was fatally wounded in his opposition to Trump on a number of these votes, and it very well could hurt his Senate chances. But particularly in a close primary Republican Senate race, but in an open primary governor's race, Cassidy could be the candidate who could build the bipartisan coalition and get elected. So if he runs, I think he would have a big impact on the race.
And it was Ray Strother who a year ago predicted Cassidy would run for governor. And at that point, it seemed like that wouldn't be a good move for the senator, but in an open primary state, it could end up helping him, the votes he made against Trump. In a closed primary, Ron, I think we both know he would be in some trouble.
I think that's right. But elections are all about the situation, the issues, who you're running against. And I think in a lot of ways, Cassidy would be a stronger gubernatorial candidate in next year than he would be a Senate candidate in 3 years from now. That's certainly something he needs to take a look at.
Lastly, as far as this year, midterm elections, which usually aren't good for the party that has the White House, and now Joe Biden's approval ratings have dipped considerably. What does that mean for Democrats nationwide?
Well, Democrats are facing a big, big problem right now. I'm looking at the polls on a daily basis, and I can tell you President Biden's poll ratings are weak, are not only poor, but they're weakening every day. Nothing he's doing is helping it. And the lower he goes, the more difficult it will be for the Democrats to win races around the country. I would handicap, and this is pretty much in agreement with, I think, most everybody else, that the Democrats will lose control of the House in the election in November. The Republicans will pick that up. And it's very possible that the Republicans could pick up control of the Senate.
Well, we will follow it with you. Thank you, Ron Fauché. First of, I hope, a few conversations this year. And great to hear the voice of Ray Strother a little earlier and that of Jill Kraft. Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Stay tuned.